if I saw a movie where you're inside a ski lodge and Bond wakes up from having, you know, sex with this woman and she says, Bond, I need you. And he goes, so does America, and proceeds to ski off a cliff and then parachute with an American flag parachute into the opening credits, I would find that hilarious.
Welcome to List Envy, the podcast that strikes like Thunderball. I'm your host, Mark Steadman, and every week I bring on a guest and together we collaborate to build a top five list on a topic they choose. This week, my guest is video game developer and previous List Envy alumna, Valerie Paris. And together we are building our top five list of James Bond gadgets.
I was exposed to Bond when I was very young. Like, I remember just religiously renting the Roger Moore. In fact, I have on VHS my copy of Live and Let Die. When I would go over to my grandparents, they would let me pick any movie. And I would always pick the same three movies. It was Die Another Day, Live and Let Die, or GoldenEye. And so I just had this, like, I don't know what it was about the character, but I was totally enraptured by this world of intrigue and, like, luxury and exotic locations. And, you know, my grandmother got sick of it. My grandpa had no problem with me renting these because he got to look at the ladies, the lovely ladies. But my grandma was like, oh my God, these are so violent. And, you know, I remember my aunt coming into the room and being like, what is this smut that you're watching? And I'm like, this is not smut. This is James Bond. And, you know, he's got some class, you know, and it's like a pool full of like half naked women. But no, so, and of course there were the video games. GoldenEye 007 on N64 was the very first video game that I ever played. I went over to my neighbor's house and we would beg to have his older brother let us play it. And you know, so I just kind of grew up, and then of course there were the movie marathons. So, you know, and they would just play them during Christmas time. It was the 007 days of Christmas. They would play them back to back to back.
That's a phenomenal. Why haven't we got that over here? That's a phenomenal name for a little marathon.
Bring
that's,
it back.
That's if wonderful. You're
a BBC, whoever's got the broadcast rights, bring
it's
that.
It's always
back.
ITV. So ITV here is our, so we our TV is weird, but, our major networks are BBC, ITV and Channel 4, and ITV always show Bond, all the time Bond. Last night it was Quantum of Solace, which I didn't watch because it's Quantum of Solace.
How dare you.
Yes, always Bond on ITV. They should be doing and in fact, I think Sky, the Rupert Murdoch company, I think Sky had a Bond channel for a while in lead up to the last film. So yeah, but 007 Days of Christmas.
Do they ever play Tomorrow Never Dies? Do they, or are they banned from playing? Did Rupert Murdoch specifically not to play Tomorrow Never? Because it's a parody of Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah.
Is Elliot Carver very explicitly is a parody of him.
Yep. Well, with that then, I think we have to do our duty here. We are talking about Bond gadgets. What, Valerie, is number one for you?
So my number one, well, it's my number four pick in the lineup, but my number one that I'm going to start with is the rebreather from Thunderball.
Aha.
So this was sort of an unassuming piece of technology. It actually, for those of you who don't know, it's a miniature scuba tank that you would just pull out of a cigar case and put on your mouth, and it would give you a few minutes of air supply that you could swim around underwater. And Bond cleverly uses this to escape a shark pool in Emilio Largo's villa in the Bahamas. And this was, the story about this goes, and I don't know if it was Jordan Klein Sr. or Ken Adams that actually came up with this device, but the story goes that when the movie came out, the British military actually called the production office and they asked, did you actually build that? Because at the time, the rebreather, a miniature scuba tank like that, did not exist. And they said, oh, no, actually, no, it's totally fake. Like, this is all for the movie. We didn't do it. It doesn't actually work. And they got to work trying to build a real one. So nowadays, it's like a staple of spy-fi, and it actually does exist in some form. But at the time, it was a totally Star Trek situation where they were like, oh, this is a cell phone, but it's not there yet. Yeah. Well, what would be your first pick, Mark?
So I'm starting off with the Garrotte watch from Russia with Love. This is a wristwatch from which a wire garrotte can be drawn. It was a Spectre weapon. It was used to assassinate a recruit. And the reason I picked this is because there are a lot of watches in Bond.
Mm-hmm.
But this was, in my research, I believe, the first one that was like a gadget watch. And there have been so many wonderful gadget watches that do various things. And I toyed with including them. But I went with this original one just because I love the idea. There's just something about... being able to, I don't know, like, I can't actually remember how it worked, but sort of being able to retract
it out of the crank.
There you go. See, that's it. I've got the right person on, obviously. So very efficient and very deadly, and that is my number one.
You know what? That's actually a really good point. I didn't make the connection because I also included just the watch,
mm-hmm.
The general watch as one of my gadget picks, but I didn't make the connection that was actually the first watch that did something, because originally he wore Bond wore the Rolex Submariner,
mm-hmm.
and this was Connery's own personal watch, and it was believed to have been picked because Fleming himself wore the Rolex Explorer, and the one from the book is the Rolex Oyster Perpetual. But in the first Connery films, it doesn't do anything. It is simply a workhorse. It's a timepiece, as Rolex has been known for. And indeed, they didn't have a sponsorship with Rolex. This was pre-days of product placement. Actually, they wouldn't have a official watch sponsor until Roger Moore showed up on the scene in 1971, 72, with the Seiko, which is actually a Japanese watch manufacturer.
And it's been Seiko all the way, hasn't it?
It was Seiko all the way through until the Dalton Bonds. Where we get some of the worst watches from the Seiko era, but they're worth talking about. But it was interesting, you know, because, in the book, Fleming always used gadgets as a way to kind of imbue character and say something about the actual characters themselves. He would often use watches to characterize different villains. For instance, Red Grant, who carries the Garrotte watch, he was described as having a bulky gold wristwatch on a well-used brown crocodile strap. You know, it's bulky. It's not the crocodile word in there. Whereas someone like Hugo Drax wore like a plain gold Patek Philippe with a black leather strap, something more feminine, something that suggested kind of a more dainty, kind of withdrawn attitude. So it's interesting seeing the way that Fleming kind of characterizes things with pieces of, you know, luxury material or branding. And certainly the watch is a good example. I wanted to ask you, Mark, in terms of watches, if we had to pick your favorite function and then the worst function from the series, would you go still with... And we're talking Bond watches, so specifically watches that Bond wears.
I would have to sort of tap my memory a little bit, but I think a lot of them were sort of more weapons orientated, and I sort of have gone away from the weapons just because I wanted to because I just love gadgety gadgets.
Yeah.
And so I think. I'm trying to think of some of the other things. You might have to refresh my memory of some of the other things that the watches did that weren't weaponry.
Sure, for sure. So my favorite was the buzzsaw and magnet from Live and Let Die. So,
oh, the magnet, yes.
Yes. So it's the first scene of Live and Let Die. He uses the magnet to unzip a lady's dress.
Yes, he does. I just saw that clip yesterday.
And apparently it's supposed to be powerful enough that it could actually block a bullet. So I can imagine if the woman had a pacemaker, he would have just shut it off,
God!
Killed her in his arms. But it also has a rotating buzzsaw, like the tip of the watch would rotate, and he uses it to cut the restraints, which I think is a pretty cool little feature. But it's also been a laser. It's been a tracker, tracking device.
Oh, yeah. There is a lot of tracking devices in the later films.
And which one is it? One of the Seiko watches is a TV. It's got a TV on it, which you would think is made up for the movie, but it's not. Seiko, in 1982, for Octopussy, actually developed a UHF frequency TV watch that you could wear on your wrist. So if anybody wants to go out and buy one.
Incredible.
Oh, all right. I'm going to avoid Googling to pick up one. Excellent. Okay. I'll throw the question back at you very quickly then. Worst thing to have on a watch?
Well, the worst thing was definitely the bleeping tracker from Octopussy. This was basically inside of the watch. They're trying to track down like a Fabergé egg that has like some Soviet plans inside of it. And there's a receiver and the watch would blink faster or slower and make a very audible blinking sound when it was closer to something. So you get this great scene where Roger Moore is trying to stealth his way around this palace. And he's right outside the door and the watch is like screaming, you know, it's like very audibly, like all the bad guys would have been able to hear it. It's totally impractical. It also just kind of blinks and shows you a general direction from your wrist, which is like, how is that useful? For a spy, very bad thing to have a very loud sound on your wrist, I would say.
I'm delighted now that I do have something like that. I do want it on my wrist. I've got it on my phone so that now when I do mislocate my AirPods, in fact, I discovered my AirPods in my bed underneath the bedclothes, and I was able to do that by using the sort of bloop, bloop, kind of find my radar thing when you get close enough, and that's quite satisfying when that happens.
That is very fun. It makes for a fun personal mini game for sure.
Yeah, absolutely, which I'm all about. What is your second pick?
My second pick is I'm going to go with the Felix Leiter,
yes.
Also known as the Leiter. This is my personal favorite gadget from the series, and I'll tell you why. There's a few reasons. Number one, it's a pun, which I like, just on the face of it. If you don't like puns, you're not going to like Bond, probably.
Yeah.
Second of all, it is one of the only gadgets that I think is set up at the beginning of the story and then really has a great payoff at the end. For those who don't remember, this is from License to Kill, which is Dalton's last film, second and last. And at the start, Felix Leiter, his longtime friend in the CIA, is attacked by the villain and his wife, Dahlia, is killed. And he himself is mortally wounded. And at the beginning of the wedding ceremony that it opens with, they give him it's a stainless steel Dunhill Unique, one of the first butane lighters. It says, from Felix to James. And it's this lighter that like ejects a just mountain of flame, you know, just like a pyrotechnics burst of flame, like totally impractical. And it kind of like surprises Bond when he like turns it on and they have like a fun moment where they're like, whoa. But so it's a gift. So it has a sentimental quality. And then at the very end of the movie, Robert Davi's villain is covered in gasoline and he uses it to set Robert Davi on fire and finally extract vengeance. So it's one of those things where it's simple enough that you feel like it could be a real thing that you could have. And it works for the story really well, and it makes for a really satisfying ending moment where Felix Leiter is, through the format of a lighter, extracting vengeance from beyond for the murder of his wife. So I think it's a pretty cool little thing.
Well, on the kind of front of lighting things, my second is the mini rocket cigarette from You Only Live Twice.
Okay, I thought this might come up.
Yeah, I just think this is, I don't know, it's just... I was watching a gritty TV drama yesterday and a guy at the beginning lights up a cigarette and I'm just like, I don't think smoking is cool, but also like we've avoided so much of that stuff and it's like, it's still a thing people do. And, it's not that it is cool, but it does look cool. Tiger Tanaka gives, Bond, a cigarette that shoots a tiny little rocket powered projectile. And it's accurate up to 30 yards. And Bond uses it in Blofeld's volcano to kill a technician. And it's just, yeah, it's tiny. It's a little, can I have a last cigarette? And, you know, love it.
Oh, I love that. No, it's a really classic one. Does he use it to kill Blofeld directly, or does he just kill somebody so he could, like, get their gun?
I'm not sure. I think he was aiming for the technician. I don't think he was aiming for Blofeld.
Oh, okay. Got it.
But I might be wrong. I was more focusing on the cigarette.
No. That is definitely a really cool little device, and one that I'm surprised doesn't show up more. I think that was, like, one of the only cigarette-based gadgets in the series.
Yeah. And even then, in that, they were making jokes about nicotine being bad for your health and all that kind of stuff. So even, you know, even in these early days of this one, I think we're still in Connery era, are we?
Yeah, Connery was in, it was the last one, last official Connery
official
movie.
Yeah. And you know, they get to make all the jokes about smoking being deadly and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, which is great setup. And when they brought Moore along, they had to distinguish his character in some ways. So what did they do? One of the things is they give him cigars instead of cigarettes. That's, like, supposed to be his characterization. And then when Brosnan comes along in Back to Tomorrow Never Dies, he opens the movie by punching somebody with a cigarette and says, oh, it's, well, what a filthy habit. So, you know, it goes from kind of, like, taking it very seriously as this, like, thing that every gentleman needs to kind of, like, turning it into a tongue-in-cheek. And now I don't think there's hardly any cigarette smoking in the Craig movies, but maybe they should bring it back.
Maybe. I'm wondering what drug Daniel Craig's Bond would do.
Oh.
Probably something subcutaneous. I don't know about intravenous. He'd have Q-knock something up, I'm sure.
Cocaine, probably.
It's probably just his cocaine, isn't it? Probably just his cocaine. You're right. Excellent. Okay, what is number three for you?
I'm going to go with something a little unconventional, and I'm going to pick the crocodile suit.
Because wow, tell me more.
The crocodile suit needs some love. You do remember this scene or this gadget?
I don't think I do.
Oh, okay. All right. So it's in Octopussy. I'm talking a lot about Octopussy today. Basically, it is a submersible that Bond can lie down in and pretend to be a crocodile. And he uses this to sneak onto the Octopussy's Island, which is, like, this island of exclusively women. And, you know, it shows him kind of, like, floating through the water, and you think it's a crocodile, and then the head opens, and it's just, like, Roger Moore's face, like, peeking out. And then at the end, he also uses it to escape, and he actually sneaks past some crocodiles who ignore him because they think it's one of their own. And it goes and it eats the deadly yo-yo henchman. So it's just a very silly thing. It's actually, what it is it's a boat on the bottom. So it does actually float. And I would assume it would have been pulled by cable or something. And it's the second time where Moore's Bond faces off against crocodiles. Because the first, he escapes from the crocodile farm in Live and Let Die. And now he gets to become the crocodile. So what a silly idea, kind of emblematic of the silliness that would define, like, Moore's Bond.
I do have a sub list for us later, after honorable mentions, because I do want to talk about some of the most ridiculous gadgets, most of them just being the shit that happens in the background in Q scenes.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to.
Yeah. So my number three, I'm going for the Ericsson JB988, a concept phone, obviously developed by Ericsson. It had lots of features, including a stun gun, a fingerprint scanner and a transmitter, an antennae lockpick, so you could take the antenna out and you could hit a key on the phone and it would just open the lock, which is incredible. And it had a flip-up design, which Ericsson then actually sort of started putting into production, as far as I am aware. I forgot which one this was from, but it was one of the Brosnans.
I can tell you that it is from Tomorrow Never Dies, because it is wielded against Dr. Kaufman, who, you know, the great, it's a great scene. It's very funny where he's got Bond at gunpoint and they can't open his car. And so he's like, this is very embarrassing for me. They seem to be having problem opening your car. And he's like, gives him the phone and he's like, oh, you just have to type it into the phone. And so he's like, well, it's like back, you know, 123 reverse send, you know, whatever the code is. And it opens up the little shock taser and tases Kaufman, where he's then able to escape. So it's a great little gadget. The Brosnan movies were very big on phones, obviously, with cell phones being more popular. And I definitely think this was the coolest. I'm glad that you included this one, because I think it is the coolest gadget phone that we see in the series.
Yeah, it's I like that, you know, there's not too many things. I mean, the lockpick is kind of insane, but like fingerprint scanner, that kind of stuff. It I mean, you know, now we sort of have that. So, you know, it's again, you know, sci-fi becomes sci-fact, or spy-fi, as I do enjoy that. But yeah, the idea of a little thing that you can, I mean, it's a sign of the time that it had an antenna, you know, as an actual flip up thing. But the idea that you could pop that in and then it's communicating presumably via some sort of Bluetooth, and it's just like, there you go, lock on pick. The lock just jiggles around in the lock, and it's just like, oh, I love it.
Have you ever watched The Lockpick Lawyer?
No, I am aware of him, though. I am aware of his oeuvre.
Where he demonstrates just how easy it is to jangle open most commercially available locks. And
yeah, it's terrifying.
I would love to see him try to get past a electronic lock with the Sony Ericsson. You know, there's a big movement towards flip phone, like old phone now. Like a lot of people are going back and buying the old retro flip phones. I would love to own the Sony Ericsson. I wonder if that exact model, you could buy some reproduction of it.
I think my favorite phone that I ever owned was a Sony Ericsson flip phone, because it just had this lovely kind of pebbly thing, and it had a little display. It had like a some sort of funky display on the front, you know, before you flipped it up, which just showed the time. And I think maybe if there was a notification or something. And it was the last phone I had before the iPhone, when everything just became a black slab. And it was lovely. Oh, I think I might have had a Sony Ericsson. I really went through a big Sony Ericsson period, actually. And I had like a Walkman phone, which was orange and white. And that was great. That was more like a candy bar phone, but it was Walkman branded.
Walkman made phones?
Well, because it was part of the Sony, because Walkman was Sony's brand, I guess. And then with it being Sony Ericsson, I think. Yeah, there was a Walkman branded phone. I think there were a couple at the time. And I think probably in the 2007, 2008-ish, I would have transferred probably 20 songs on there, which probably would have been what would have fit.
I love that. So I had a question about that, but I totally blanked on it. I wanted that phone, and I want the like Motorola Matrix phone that like almost like a gun draw, like like really chunky phone that kind of shoots out. But no, I think that's a really great choice.
Thank you very much. Number four.
So I am going to go with the grenade pen.
Lovely, 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 lovely. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Now, similar to the lighter, it's set up at the beginning of GoldenEye in the Q Lab scene with, you know, a fantastic bit of wordplay. Does the whole pen is mightier than the sword thing. Brosnan's holding it up. He activates the timer on it, and he goes, how long did you say the fuse was? And then, you know, Q's like, grow up. But it's the great thing about it is it's the closest the Bond movies have ever come to having a Hitchcockian suspense device built into the movie.
Yeah.
Right? Because no other gadget are you kind of like, oh, I wonder when he's going to use it. They're all kind of like, oh, you know, I guess I remember that he had that. Like, I guess he remembers that he could like take that out and use it. But like, it doesn't feel suspenseful. But this, it has a timer built in, which, you know, Hitchcock was all about. If you know, the best thing you can do to make suspense is to tell the audience that there is a bomb under the table, but don't tell any of the party guests. And then you just naturally have suspense. So at the climax of GoldenEye, Bond's pen gets taken by Boris, the computer programmer. And he's like anxiously clicking on it as he's trying to decode something on the computer. And they're all standing around at gunpoint. And Bond is like carefully watching the number of clicks to see when it's going to go off. Now, I did rewatch the scene because I did want to count the number of clicks.
Oh, no. I rewatched it, but I didn't do the math on this.
I really wanted to do the math on it because it's, you know, the Q gives it very specific rules. He kind of says 3 clicks to arm the 4-second fuse and then another 3 to disarm it. And I, again, like, I don't care too much. Like, this is all in the service of the movie, but that grenade should have gone off twice before it actually did.
Oh, no.
Like the first time that he arms it, 8 seconds pass, and then he disarms it again. And then the second time that he arms it, if you count, it actually a whole minute and 30 seconds goes by where just it doesn't blow up. And then for the audience's sake, they have him like click it, you know, in Bond's face like 3 times, and then he like knocks it out of his hand and it blows everything up. But obviously, at the time, you don't really care, but...
No. I mean, 8 seconds is forgivable because we can do the whole, you know, often cinema plays around with time and you can cut. And so when you cut, we sort of lose time a little bit. But a minute and a half, I mean, that's just insulting.
It's pretty bad. But, you know, it's one of those things where some of the clicks are heard off screen. So they're definitely put in by the sound department.
Yeah.
Other times, they're insert shots. So they had to edit around, I imagine, like the actual suspense of the scene to pace it properly, and then the actual footage they had of clicking it and, you know, making that readable to the audience. But it's still a great scene. It's really a wonderful gadget. It's a Steel Parker Jotter for anybody who's really wants to know what kind of pen it is.
Oh, lovely. Thank you. That was my number 5. Excellent. So my number 4 is from Dying of the Day. It is the single digit sonic agitator.
What is that? The single digit. What is that? Remind me what that is.
Yeah. It is a quote unquote standard issue ring. So it's a ring that you popped on your finger, and Q demonstrates by taking Bond's weapon and shooting a glass pane, and, you know, to demonstrate that the glass is unbreakable, and then this sonic agitator emits a sound that shatters the glass.
Oh, I do remember now. Yeah.
And it's just you just twist it on your finger, and it'll and it can also disable another person is the description I have.
Okay.
But it will, you know, you see it shattering a big pane of glass. So yeah,
how does he use it at the end? Does he use it to like shatter like a glass floor? I remember he's like in the lair of Gustav. What the heck is the villain's name?
Oh God!
It's not Gustav Graves.
Yeah, no, I have to bow to your knowledge on this one, I'm afraid.
Yeah. So I believe he uses it in the villain's lair to shatter the floor. Yeah, it is Gustav Graves. I don't know. I doubted myself for a second. He shatters the glass floor of the lair. Never make a floor out of glass when you're dealing with James Bond. And also, just shoot Bond. That's really, if you're.
I mean, that's rule number one: is if you see James Bond, shoot James Bond.
Just shoot him immediately. Don't play his game.
Let's. I want to speak to you as a 1-to-1. And let's talk as gentlemen. No, just shoot him.
Exactly. No, that's a really beautiful gadget. I do remember being really wowed, and I watched that film recently with my girlfriend, and she specifically really liked that gadget because it is a fun little magic trick they set up where John Cleese demonstrates that the glass can't be broken, and then this little, because you could imagine that could work. You know, I think like Sonic, they probably do have something like that. Like Sonic weapons are a real thing. What do you think about the movie Die Another Day on the whole? Because I actually have kind of a controversial take on this movie.
Ooh, okay. I don't remember being enthralled by it. I remember being I was sort of losing my interest in Bond at the time, and I just remember watching it on the TV. It wasn't one that I'd gone to the cinema to watch. I was a big John Cleese fan, so I was always happy to see John Cleese as Q. I think that's always a great comic character, and I think Ben Whishaw does an amazing job of Q now. And if I remember rightly, there was I was looking in the list when I was researching, couldn't find it, but I'm sure that was the film with the car that basically goes invisible because it's got lots and lots of teeny tiny cameras.
Listen, this film, it's worth a critical reappraisal. Most people hate it. A lot of people say that it's the worst Bond movie. I would actually put it among the best. And I would actually say that it's Brosnan's second best behind GoldenEye. And it's just a lot of fun. You have to just turn your brain off and embrace that this is sort of...
Yes.
This is Brosnan doing his version of Moonraker. Mm. It's almost like the pair, like if you can look at Moonraker as like a parody of the Moore era movies, this is like a parody of the Brosnan movies.
Nice.
And there's this really great scene where Q, John Cleese's Q, he's like, they're in like a subway tunnel. And he goes, Bond, it's your new car. And he's got on the subway track, a blank, empty, like platform rolls out. And he's like, oh, here it is. And Bond's like, I think you've been down here a little too long. And then he presses the button and then like it comes to life. It's obviously like the invisible refractive car, which it's a very funny moment. It's something that I think is kind of believable because they do like try to make a note that it's adaptive camouflage. It has little cameras that are, you know, and it's not entirely invisible. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of, it is a fun little movie. And then he gives Bond the instruction manual for the car. And it's got automatic shotguns that like kind of lock onto things. And Q's like, you should be able to shoot through this in a couple of days. And Bond throws it up in the air. The shotguns turn it into a million pieces. And he goes, it only took a couple seconds, Q. Which, you know, just classic. Brosnan's delivery was always really great with that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, there you go. So you're number five then.
Well, you took the wash, so I'm gonna have to pick something else from my list. I'm gonna go with the Golden Gun, unless this was your number one.
No, I'm happy with the Golden Gun.
Okay, yeah, I was gonna say we'll do a shout out for the Golden Gun.
Yeah.
So the Golden Gun, yeah, I mean, it's the only cool thing about the movie, the man with the Golden Gun, other than the record setting, Mustang car jump, and the fact that you have Ian Fleming's nephew Christopher Lee, the legendary rock and roll artist. That's what he's best known for, right? Is his from his doom metal band?
Sure,
Christopher Lee.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
not him playing Dracula.
No. Or any of the Lord of the Rings. No.
Yeah, none of that. Sauron, none of that. And you know, the Golden Gun. It is a gadget, and I will defend it as a gadget because it is a bunch of little gentlemanly luxury items that turns into a gun. It's a gold lighter, a ballpoint pen, a cufflink, and a couple other little things, and you can kind of assemble it to make this like one-shot gadget that fires dum-dum rounds. Dum-dum rounds are rounds that when they hit you, they expand the inside, dealing more internal damage. Not that we have to get graphic and with all that, but it explains why it's the legend is that, you know, you just get hit with it anywhere and it kills you instantly. So it's something that is iconic, of course, of the whole series. It goes on to play a role in just about every video game that comes out has the one-shot kill gun. And I think it's just an elegant little beautiful thing. And I think, I think it deserves a place on the list for sure.
You will get no argument from me. It's... yeah, it's a proper sort of hacked together thing, it does its job once, and then that's it. Excellent. Okay, so my last one then, since yes, we agreed on something else, is this is silly Smart Blood from Spectre. So this is one of many tracking devices, and it was an implant into Bond, and it's nanoparticles that allow Q and his branch to monitor the whereabouts of Bond via GPS.
Oh, wait, which movie is this in?
So this is in Spectre, but it is also apparently, according to my research, used in, referenced in No Time to Die as well, which is interesting because we don't tend to see the same kind of gadget reused or referenced again in across films.
Well, semi-spoiler for No Time to Die, it does involve like nanoparticles in the blood. But I didn't remember that that was the explanation. It's actually, Spectre is the one that I've seen probably the least in the series. Mm-hmm. So I did not remember that. So how does it work? He gets injected with it and they can kind of like, they don't trust him to have just like a little implant because he can tear the implant out if they don't want to track him.
I think that's it. I think so, because yeah, the couple of other trackers that I'd seen where they can check his vital signs and that kind of stuff. And I guess, yeah, they've just got to go with something that he can't throw away or pretend to swallow.
Would this be, is this sort of like an aspirational gadget? Like you want your own smart blood to... So people don't lose you, or people are... where did Mark go?
No, I think I'm not like a prepper, but I'm quite happy not being on too many grids.
Yeah.
I'd like to retain an air of mystery, you know?
Yeah.
I think we should all be afforded that.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's interesting because I think they use the nanobot idea a few times. They use it in the game Everything or Nothing. Willem Dafoe's character is like using nanobots to destroy the New Orleans levees, which was just 2 years before Hurricane Katrina.
Ooh.
So it was the weird thing with that game is that the whole point of it was you were supposed to stop the levees from flooding the city. It's like, all right, well, it's going to happen. We know what happens anyway, unfortunately, but it is a clever little idea, I think. There weren't a lot of gadgets in the Craig era, famously.
No, and it was even referenced with it the first time we meet Q was it Skyfall?
Yeah. Where he's in front of the painting.
We don't go, yeah, that's right. And we don't go in for that sort of thing anymore. It's just like, oh, okay, so you're just sucking all of the joy out of these films.
Yeah,
then.
Right. I feel like we got the more grounded bond with Craig, which I'm a fan. You know, I liked his tenure. Mm-hmm. But I think, where do you think we should go now that they're maybe going to cast Aaron Taylor Johnson as Bond? It's rumored. What do you, if you had to choose, if you, Mark Steadman, was like, what direction should we take the character in for the return? What would you go with?
I think it's tricky because I think we have to have this question of whether, and I think we I think Bond should probably, if Bond is going to continue, I think Bond should probably evolve with the times. I think that's okay that he does, because I think, but it's so weird because like you're getting me on a thing here, but the reboot was so strange for me because we're going back to Casino Royale, so it feels like we're setting things up. I feel like he meets Felix Leiter for the first time, but we've got the same M as before.
Yeah.
Like, I did make a decision, make a choice. So this, it's really tricky whether we have a Bond that sort of moves with the times a little bit, or do we have one that's still a little bit old-fashioned? And I am now entering the second half of my life and realizing that the world is not really, it's still fine for a middle-aged white man. But I think it's because I consume media that is meant for much younger people. Like I actually spend quite a lot of time on TikTok and enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
By doing that, you sort of realize, wow, this like stuff isn't made for me anymore. I am not the person that everything is made for. And that's fine. So I have no complaint about that. That is no, you know, I'm not railing against that at all. It's as it should be. Every generation has it and I'm fine with that. But what's interesting is that, you know, there are moments where I'm a progressive as a human, but also there's parts of me that I'm just like, I like the idea that the Bond might still be slightly old fashioned in some ways.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know. But at the same time, like we want a Bond that feels like it doesn't exclude and feels like it's in some way. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's a real tricky one. I think you probably just wanted a lighthearted answer and I went,
No, I actually really, I really like your answer because I think it is a tricky thing. You know, as speaking as a woman, you know, I'm a diehard lesbian, but I do have exceptions. And one of my exceptions is Timothy Dalton. I just think he's so charming. He's so beautiful.
I think I might be with you in the same.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah,
sort
yeah.
Of,
no, but... I think, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
The thing about those movies that I did really appreciate is that he had a sense of genuine romance in them. Like, I could really buy the romantic partnerships. He was very charming. He seemed very caring and in tune. Like, the relationships in all of the other ones are very kind. Obviously, at Pierce Brosnan, it's like, hi, I've met you. Okay, you have a silly name, you know, Philip a Thong or whatever. And then, like, you know, they're going to bed in, like, the next scene, which is fine for that era. You know, it's what it was. It was tongue in cheek. But I think to have Bond kind of grow with the times more, I think what they could do is they could bring back an element that is genuinely romantic that I think appeals to both men and women, but also brings back some of the fun from the earlier movies. Because I think the Craig era was so serious and, you know, gritty and kind of like, oh, what does it mean to be an assassin? And oh, he's so tortured and everything like that. And I think people are kind of ready these days for a little bit of escapist fun. Maybe not too much escapist fun, but I think we're allowed.
Yeah.
And nowadays we have people walking around that are straight up Bond villains. I mean, I know Amazon Studios owns the MGM franchise now, which I think they should just cast Jeff Bezos. I think there is a sales pitch to Jeff Bezos where we could be like, no, it's going to be like really fun. You could be like this like fun little megalomaniacal evil billionaire. And I think he would kind of go for it. He would like play into it. But I was reading actually the undeveloped script for the third Dalton movie that never got made. And the villain is straight up like Elon Musk. Like he's like an autonomous vehicles manufacturer who just kind of like goes off the deep end and wants to like take over the world's like, you know, robotics manufacturing. And he's got like a space program. And I was like, you know, if you just cranked the dial on some of these like guys that we have today, you could put them in Goldfinger, you know, territory.
So if you want to hear two people getting Bond wrong, one of whom is also an American, then you can listen to my episode with Tom Peterson from back in the day, early 2020. I think March 2020 was when that came out. Very unresearched, unlike Valerie in this particular episode, who is kicking the new knowledge. But also do check out Valerie Paris's previous episode as well, which was all about top five point and click adventure games from the early sort of 90s era. And that was a ton of fun as well. So yes, we will return to Valerie shortly. But coming up, we've got another returning guest in John Hickman, and we are going to be talking about piano pop. We've got sci-fi films coming up. We've got music that sort of drags us to the dance floor, and a very special episode after that as well, which I won't tell you about, just because I'd like to retain some sort of an air of mystery, as I've previously said. If you want to keep up with the show, if you are new around here, hi, welcome. You are so welcome. ListEnvyPod.com is where you can hear all of the episodes, follow the podcast in Apple and Spotify and all the places. And if you would like an email from me every week where I talk about other podcasts that I think are good, and specifically talk about a minute in their audio and tell you why I think it's fun and interesting, then you can head to thebigminute.com and subscribe to my newsletter there. Actually, I mean, they're both just shortcuts to my website, so, you know, either way, you'll find it there. All right. That's enough ado. Let us return to our top five list of Bond gadgets.
Right, we have an important task before us. We now, having gone through our list, we now need to see if we can combine them. I've made a provisional sort of list here. So let's see how this lands with you. I'm putting the grenade pen at number one. I think that's great. And we both picked it. The rebreather at number two. I want to put the cigarette rocket in at number three. the Ericsson phone at number four, and the Garot watch at number five, because it's the first watch that does other things. How does that strike you?
How does that match strike me?
Mm.
I like your list. I definitely think that the Garot watch should be on there. I do want to make a case for the Felix Leiter, though. Yeah, because I feel like in terms of representation of eras, we have representation from Connery. So we're leaving out more, which is interesting that we're leaving out more because his era has the most gadgets.
Yes. So where did the Felix Leiter come from?
But that's from License to Kill.
Nah.
See, nobody likes that one except me and one other British author that I know of.
I think that was the crocodile suit the only Roger Moore thing that you had?
Okay, it is the only one that I had.
That's going to be tricky to put in.
No, I don't want to put the crocodile suit in. Okay, so I will agree with your list if you can agree to give a very special mention, a very honorable mention to the Felix Leiter at a number six slot.
I am perfectly happy to do that. I'm just wondering, yeah. Because I was kind of thinking, could we lose the cigarette? But I can't lose the cigarette. And you can't have a cigarette without a lighter. So number six, the Felix Leiter. So, okay, here we go. Running down the list from six to one, the Felix Leiter, the Garot watch, the Ericsson JB988, the cigarette, the rebreather, and the grenade pen. Valerie Paris, do you consent to this list?
I consent to this list.
What do we have? Was there anything else on your list that didn't make your top five?
Yeah, I have three honorable mentions. One of them is one that I actually thought you might bring up, which is the attaché case from Russia with Love.
Yeah, no, that was a good one.
That was like his first gadget, really, because it had the concealed knife. It had the concealed gas. It also kind of brings that like suspense scene where he's like fist fighting with Red Grant in the car. I also had the ejector seat from Goldfinger.
Yes.
If we had to consider that its own gadget, you must be joking. Which I looked it up to see if there were any land vehicles that did have an ejector seat ever built into them. And it's never been done. No one has ever actually built an ejector seat, even for fun, into a car. For some reason, we could be the first. Maybe Mythbusters did it. I don't know. I would have to check the Mythbusters catalog. But
yeah, you just always have to make sure that it's either a roll top or whatever, convertible, or you've got a really big sunroof, because otherwise you're just going to blow both of you up.
Yeah. Why does this car have like a section that's like perfectly square and also seems to have like extra seatbelts and like danger signs on it? I don't understand. I could see it working in maybe like a Hummer.
Yeah.
Because then you could drive the Hummer off a cliff and then you could like eject from it for fun.
Yeah.
And then I will say Jaws's teeth.
Oh,
was
yeah.
My other. Sure. Because it's kind of a gadget. You know, he had to have somebody install those titanium tooths in his maw.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses it to great effect. You know, he uses it to deflect bullets, to kill people, and to be fed to sharks because his jaw got attached to a big magnet.
And to charm a lady.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. He's got the silver smile, not a golden smile, but a silver smile. Do you have any runner-ups for your list?
Yeah, I only had the one, which was... And I mainly picked this because it brought back, I had this vague memory of something that I remember from the 80s because I'm old. And it was the, so there was a whistle activated keychain from The Living Daylights. And it did a bunch of things. It could release stun gas or it could explode, depending on what tune you whistled. And this would have happened because, and I was like, as I was looking through, I was going, I have a memory of these things existing, obviously not with the weaponry involved, but I was like, that was I'm sure that was a thing that people had. And I just remember one person, it might have been a neighbor, had a keychain that if you whistled, it would beep. And so you could find your keys.
It brings me to kind of like one of my final wrap-up questions, which is if you could have in real life any one of the gadgets from the list or just from the Bond series in general, for your own personal use to do something, what would it be?
Oh, it might. It's probably going to be the phone.
Yeah, it's got to be the phone, right?
Yeah, because it's practical, but also the things that it can do are really useful. But then it is also a phone.
Yeah, definitely. Because like, I would love a watch. You know, if a watch had like a buzzsaw or a laser, that would be cool for me. But I might have to go with the crocodile suit. I think you can catch me in the Hudson River. Just, I would spend so many days out there with my croc friends, just sailing around, just freaking people out with my crocodile boat.
Living the croc life.
Yeah.
I love it. Okay. I have to talk to you about some of the silly gadgets. And the one that first springs to mind is an arm cast. This is from For Your Eyes Only, and it's something. It looked Bond. It's an ordinary arm cast for a broken arm, except that it can also be used on an assailant coming from the back by springing out, and bashing the perpetrator.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's like the specificity of needing that. So does that mean every agent is walking around with a broken arm just in case they need to hit someone from behind? It's just such a...
Oh, absolutely. Oh. You've got a lot of disability-themed devices, right? You've got that. You've also got the wheelchair that fires rockets out of the cast boot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a very specific use case. also, the bagpipe flamethrower would be a very specific use case. And I'm trying to remember, one of my favorites that is just very silly is the ghetto blaster from, which is just, he's like, something for the Americans. And it's like, he's got like a boombox on his shoulder and it fires like an RPG out. I don't know if you remember this one too. This is also from License to Kill.
Mm-hmm.
There is a Polaroid camera that takes X-ray photographs.
I remember reading about it. I don't remember. Yeah, I would have watched it, but it's been a while.
It's not funny on its own. The funny thing about it is that they take a photograph accidentally with it. And in the photograph, they show the final photograph. There's Bond, Q, and the girl standing in the foreground. And then in the actual movie, there's a painting on the wall in the background. And when they show the developed photograph, they have the X-ray of, obviously, the three actors, but they also have an X-ray of the people drawn in the painting. Which I didn't realize until the last time I watched it. I was like, that's like, you know, so it'd be like the Mona Lisa, but you take an X-ray photograph and it's like her skeleton somehow was developed onto the photographic paper.
That's incredible. Oh, I love it when films are dumb. Speaking of, there's the revolving sofa that eats people, also from The Living Daylights, and a phone booth trap from GoldenEye, which Q is just testing. We've got just an airbag which expands and crushes the person using the phone booth.
It literally kind of like breaks the scene entirely, right? Because it goes off in the background and the guy looks genuinely in pain. And you can hear him like squeegeeing down the glass of the phone booth. Very good. I love that one. And then at the end, of course, he's like, that's my favorite Q-Lab scene. I think the GoldenEye Q-Lab scene is brilliant. Because at the end, he like takes the submarine sandwich, as we call it, or the hoagie from Q. And he's like, what does this do? And he's like, don't touch that. That's my lunch.
Absolutely lovely. Valerie, this has been an absolute pleasure. What are you up to at the moment? When last we spoke, you were developing video games. The Butterfly Collector?
Yeah, I came out with Butterfly Collector, Apollosis. I've come out with a couple games since then. Organaria, point-and-click adventure games. If you haven't checked out the point-and-click adventure game episode with Mark Stedman, you should definitely watch
it. One of my favorites.
Right after this
one. One of my favorites.
But currently, I just finished publishing a game book called Somnambulist. Here it is. It is a throwback to, I don't know if you remember the old fighting fantasy games, Warlock of Firetop Mountain by Steve Jackson Games, where you could like choose your own adventure, but there was like dice mechanics and combat mechanics and things like that. This is a modern take on those old games. It's a sci-fi interstellar romance set in Manhattan initially about a sleep paralysis demon and a cult. So I definitely, if you are interested, check that out. It's available on my itch.io page.
Absolutely wonderful. Thank you. Well, this has been an absolute pleasure. A lovely and worthy sequel to our previous episode. So, Valerie, thank you so much for joining me on List Envy.
Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate it. Thanks for letting me nerd out about this for an hour with you.